We are going to ask everyone to do *6 to mute their line. That will allow us to have a clean conversation from the noise in the background. But please feel free at any point to press *6 to unmute your line so you can ask questions. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mike Miller, and we'll jump right into the packet. Everyone should have gotten a packet and a slide deck. And just to remind everybody that this call does get recorded along with the slide deck to our website. So if there's information that you want to circle back on, or if you want to share the call with somebody else, you can always refer them to our website. With that, I'm going to turn it to Mike and start the conversation.
Thank you, Debbie, and good afternoon, everyone. Nice to be here with you at midday. I guess I should be glad that we're starting this call at noon, because then we'd at least have a little bit of an update in the market that we wouldn't have known about if we started at 9 a.m. So needless to say, it's been a very interesting time. I will spend a few minutes on the current market climate. Along the way, when you have questions you want to probe deeper, I'd be happy to get into more detail about it. But one of the things you probably won't be surprised to hear is that we are, generally speaking, unconcerned is not probably the right word, but we're not incredibly focused on short-term results and tend instead to look at volatility and emotional markets as something that, you know, generally speaking, as is the case this time, are built on very real risks, but ultimately aren't risks that affect us for the next, let's say, 10 to 20 years, which is our time horizon. So we have to think about it. It's a bit of a juxtaposition there in terms of how you think about the day-to-day versus, you know, the decades that we're predominantly concerned with. So with that said, if you turn, and I'll get to the 2020 fund in a minute, if you turn to page 2, we have results through year-end, which actually at first glance might say, well, these are woefully out of date. This possibly, how much of this have you lost would be a question I'd be asking. So let me give you that number right away so you're ready for it. Actually, the most up-to-date number we have, which is just actually through a little earlier today, the portfolio, the long-term pool is down 4% year-to-date. The socially responsible pool is down closer to 3% year-to-date. And the midterm pool, I don't recall the exact number, but I believe it's going to be down around 2.5% to 3% year-to-date as well. So one of the things that's interesting, given all of the...
what just happened, but if someone could, who just had a call, could you push *6 so that way we can keep the line quiet? Thank you.
So as you go through this, obviously the gains of last year are still fairly secure at this point. One thing I unfortunately won't say and can't say is that is what will happen next. We don't really know what will happen next. The coronavirus and other issues that upset markets from time to time, you know, these are very serious issues, of course. Health is obviously an incredibly important issue for all of us. Importantly, this has severe economic implications, which could be short-term, they could be medium-term. Who's to say? And I'll talk a bit later about why, you know, we don't just say, well, because we don't know what's going to happen next, because the markets are a little more fraught with peril and risk, should we change our strategy? So I will come back to that in a moment. But just to state for just a quick second, so now that I've given you that, we've given up maybe a quarter at most of the gains of last year. Now the gains of last year don't seem like they're quite as fleeting. Mm-hmm. So let's spend just a quick minute on this page, too. So the pool is up 17.1%. A relatively rare period of underperforming its benchmark, which is up 17.9, and the 70-30 mix, which is up 21.2. So we lag that, and in part, that's part of what's helping us right now, which is that the portfolio is considerably more conservative than either of these indices, particularly the 70-30. So when difficult times arrive, and as you all know, they always do, this portfolio doesn't tend to go down as much as those indices. Now, one of the trade-offs that people frequently make when they're trying to protect themselves against short-term declines is they give up the long-term gains that we really must have. So we can't compromise on long-term gains. And as you look across the page, you'll see the portfolio, particularly compared to its benchmark, has outperformed by pretty significant margins. And I would tell you the thing we're most proud about, there are really two things here. One is that every single number across the page has outperformed CPI plus 5. And that's ultimately what this portfolio is here to do. Sometimes the markets make that easy for us, like last year. Sometimes they make it much harder for us to do that. But that's the prize, essentially. And I think the thing that we're probably most pleased about, and you have to go way, way back here, but since we started looking for the foundation back in, we really started in late 01, but the portfolio has changed in the first quarter of 2002. Since that time, the portfolio has earned 7.4% per year. This is net of investment manager fees. And it's way ahead of its benchmarks, and also even slightly ahead of CPI plus 5. So that's that almost perfect answer for us, which is that the market did not make it easy to be CPI plus 5, but the portfolio did, merely because of some of the principles I'll talk about in a minute. The SR pool is next. You can see it also having a really nice run of performance. Helped out.
Hello. Whoever has
their
dog is barking, I'm sure you know it's you. Can you just press star 6? Thanks so much.
I like the dog, that sounds good.
So the
SR pool has done extremely well. It's actually outperformed, other than a 10-year period, the long-term pool. And that's largely because it's a more aggressive portfolio in the sense that it has has more in public equities.
Mm-hmm.
And that has given it a nice tailwind here, which has been great. It's a great portfolio, so we're certainly not going to say anything that would be anything but positive about it, because it's a fabulous portfolio. It is a more aggressive portfolio, so even though this year to date so far, it's actually still doing a little bit better than the long-term pool. Long-term, it's a little more susceptible to losses in the short term, and I think that's something else to think about. And last but not least is the midterm pool, which is intended for shorter duration philanthropy. You know, if you're going to be spending down large sums of your fund in the next 3 to 5 years, let's say, that pool is appropriate because it's about a 50-50 mix of stocks and bonds. It's more conservative than the other two. If you turn to slide 3 for a moment, now we do one more thing, which is I showed you a minute ago that the long-term pool has significantly outperformed most of its benchmarks over most periods of time. So now we switch this to look at how is it done compared to other endowments and foundations. And so this is the Investmetrics Endowment Foundation Universe, which comes out quarterly and consists of actually up to about 1,100 endowments and foundations participating in it. So what you're looking at, the green bar shows you the portfolio's returns, which was about a minute ago. Underneath it is the median return of the universe. And so you can see actually the one-year period I mentioned before being more conservative has hurt the portfolio here as well. It's dropped into below median, which, by the way, has happened before and will happen again. So we're not particularly focused on a one-year number, but we do think about it, of course. And then above that, you can see the quartile and the percentile. Can we give you a quick, for those of you who don't think about statistics all day? The quartile means which of the 25 percentiles are you in, essentially. In other words, first quartile means top 25%. Second quartile means you're above the median, but not the top 25%. Third quartile means you're below the median, but not the bottom 25%, which is fourth quartile. So let's focus on the second set of numbers, which are probably more interesting, which is the percentile. So now I'll explain what that is, essentially. So 67%, which is the one-year number, that means that 67% of the endowments and foundations did better than the community foundation did. That's the number that we obviously aren't thrilled about, and that's how we ended up in the third quartile. Now, with that said, we think portfolio is positioned to be back in its leadership role over time, and that's what you can also see happen. So you look across the page, 41st percentile for the 3 years, which means above the median, but not the top quartile. And then you get into basically a bunch of numbers that look pretty similar, although it changes which quartile you're in. 20%, 28%, 24%, those are all essentially at or around the top quartile result, a little better, a little worse. And again, that last number, which is the one, again, we're not going to overly focus on because you have to do more than just long-term numbers here, but the April 1st, 2002, again, that's that start point. That's top quartile, and most importantly, top 4%, which means that 4% of endowment foundations did better, or maybe another way to say that would be 96% of endowment foundations did worse than the community foundation over this basically 17-plus year period. So this is the scorecard, which, you know, we are generally speaking pleased with. It's never going to be consistent. That's not the strategy here. We don't know how to do that, at least not without compromising on the long term. And so that's the way we think about all of that. If you turn to the next slide, one of the key things to remember is when we talk about the current climate, you'll be disappointed, I think, with the lack of insights that we have. We don't know anything that other people don't know. We don't know how long what the path of the virus is in terms of health effects, economic effects. We don't know how the market's going to react to it. We don't know if it's going to disappear for a while, then come back. We have no idea of what's going to happen. And no matter how hard you try or how hard you work, you just can't know the future. Unfortunately, it's a complicated thing. And our argument to people a lot of times is that there's always uncertainty out there. It's just certain moments of time where it becomes much more obvious to everybody how much uncertainty there is and what can happen. And when those things kind of punch you in the face, like right now, it can be very frightening. except it can be a little less frightening when you realize that these things are always sitting out there somewhere. You have to make decisions, you have to think about things, knowing that, you know, weird stuff happens. And when it does happen, you can't be in a position where you need to know what happens, what's going to happen, excuse me. So what that means from the strategy perspective is this long-term outlook idea. And it's really controlled, explained on page 4. So one, be diversified. That's what maintaining a mix of stocks, bonds, and alternatives is all about, is we're diversified. So up until recently, you know, a good argument to be made, we'll kind of take this head on a little later, that why don't you just put all your money in the S&P 500? It's been the best performer for 10 years, and actually now stretching it even longer periods of time. Why wouldn't I just do that? And the answer is because that's concentration. And if the U.S. market is no longer the leader going forward, you know, you could be in the wrong area, not the right area, and we're not willing to take on that risk of being in 100% in the wrong area or largely in the wrong area. We have a strategy which will put us in the right area for part of the portfolio and the wrong area for other parts of the portfolio. And it's that balance that is really important in terms of long-term outcomes. Second point, we spend money on fees. We hire managers, some of them cheaper than others. And when we spend more money on fees, we are thinking only about net outcomes and likelihood of success. So you can't overpay for management. If you do that, your likelihood of success isn't very good. But you can't always be trying to minimize fees when you have the kind of portfolio that Kingdee Foundation has, which is one with a lot of access to some pretty extraordinary investors that are not available to most of us, by the way. There's a club out there of people who are really, really good at what they do. Some of them charge a little more than others, but the net results are worth it. And last but not least, as it says at the bottom, think about risk all the time. The danger people have, I think, is from an emotional standpoint, is they don't think about risk when markets are going up, but then they suddenly start thinking about it when they're going down. That's not a good strategy. You need to be thinking about risk all the time, and that's how you get into a diversified mix. So page 5 looks at that information. You can see the long-term pool has 52.5% in stocks. The SR pool has 60% in stocks, and the midterm pool has 47.5%. You can then see the bond exposures where the SR pool has quite a bit more than the long-term pool, and the midterm pool is very balanced, as I mentioned earlier. Then the long-term pool also has hedge funds and private equity, whereas the SR pool just has private equity. And that is why I said earlier that the SR pool should do better in rising markets. It's got more in public stocks than the long-term pool does, excuse me. It also has more in bonds, which is you went back and said, how is it that the SR pool is doing better in 2020 than the long-term pool? And the answer is the bond piece of the portfolio. For those of you who are watching this, one of the things that's amazing to watch is how low interest rates in the United States have gotten. We're now sub 1% on 10-year treasuries, which is a stunning, stunning thing. And actually, it's an outcome which is really, if it's a real thing, if it's a real measurement of what economic conditions are going to be like going forward, and I think that's questionable, it's pretty frightening, because that's predicting that we're going to have deflation or zero interest rates or negative interest rates in the United States seem more and more possible, which is really quite unsettling, I have to say. But the mixes are what they are, and you can see they're very diversified. There are non-U.S. stocks, U.S. stocks. And by the way, back to my earlier comment, it's the non-U.S. stocks that have really caused us to be, you know, essentially a little disappointed with some of the outcomes, because those stocks are not keeping up with U.S. stocks. But we do know one thing, this too shall change. U.S. stocks don't always outperform, believe it or not, and non-U.S. stocks don't always underperform. They will switch places, and when they switch places, this portfolio will be stand ready to benefit from that. If you turn to page 6, one of the other things that we're doing that defy conventional wisdom right now is we continue to use active management. We love index funds, don't get me wrong, but we really also love active management, but it's got to be successful active management. And if you went back to the first page, you'll see the portfolio over time, with the exception of this last year, which actually has nothing to do with active management, has outperformed its benchmarks and other fees. So there's only one way to do that, which is to have successful active management, and that's been a hallmark of the strategy for years. And that's very out of vogue these days, as it should be, by the way, because active management is a loser's game at the end of the day, but it's not a universally negative experience for people. So the ground rules at our firm, which the Vermont Kingdee Foundation pursues as well, are these four steps. One is returns are always accompanied by risk. So we think about managers in terms of what risks are they taking and what returns can they earn for us. There's no such thing as a manager doesn't have risk. There's organizational risk, there's portfolio risk, there's all kinds of things that happen in organizations. And so that gets to the second point, which is we spend a lot of time thinking about and looking at the people who manage this money. We need to know them, we need to spend time with them. One of the problems with the coronavirus at the moment for us is it's interfering with global travel, which is something that we do a ton of. And so we're a little bit on our back foot in terms of not sure how to handle that problem. Well, hopefully that will not be a long-term issue. But we do need to go out and see these people, see them where they work, and understand what makes them tick. That's a big, big part of the equation. Third point where we don't take risks is on operations. We actually at Colonial have a 4-person operations due diligence team right now that does nothing but make sure we don't have a Bernie Madoff type situation in these portfolios or something that's just not something that's amiss. There's interestingly, there are thankfully on institutional level, there's not a ton of Bernie Madoffs that we have to worry about. We worry about it anyway. But there are a lot of little things that have to be done right, and that's what that group is there to do. So I'm going to skip past page 7 and ask you to look at page 8 for a moment. So I wanted to preemptively talk about the hedge fund portfolio because that's usually the most controversial part of the foundation strategy. And it's something which, by the way, the investment committee also is always in hot debate about in terms of that. In fact, we're talking about the asset mix in our meeting this afternoon, and we'll see where that all turns out. But the reality is that despite their bad and well-deserved negative reputation, hedge funds have been a productive part of this portfolio over time, and this chart is meant to show you why. So this is a volatility versus return diagram. I'm going to come back a little later to why moderating volatility is so important for philanthropy. But let's just start with a moment on this piece. So this is since February of 2003, and that date was chosen because that's the first day that hedge funds are added to this portfolio. So we've actually had now almost a 17-year experience with hedge funds. This is through December, so it's not quite 17 years here. And what you're looking at, the way you read this graph, is returns are the vertical scale, higher is better. Volatility or standard deviation is the horizontal scale. As you move to the right, you have a more volatile, i.e. a lot more movement of the value of your assets. When markets are plunging like they are now, you're more susceptible to that. When they're rising like last year, you're also more susceptible to that. And the idea here is what you want to do is you want to try to keep your returns as high as you can and not have too much volatility. And I'll show you a little later why the volatility actually isn't just a let's see if we can sleep well at night kind of idea. It's much more important than that. It actually has a real impact on how your funds work and how effective they are in terms of their philanthropic throughput. So now let's look at the graph for a second. The diamond on the far right-hand side of the page, that's a 70% hit to the global stocks and bonds. That's the benchmark that was up a lot more than the portfolio last year. The blue circle is the portfolio, and you can see it's had actually more return than the 70-30 over time, and actually quite a bit less volatility, and that's important. I think we'll come back to that later. The yellow circle on the bottom to the left, that's the bond market, which has been, as you know, as I mentioned earlier, a stunningly high returning vehicle for the last year and a half, which is just incredible. But over the long term, it's returned about 4% a year and has had a lot less volatility than the stock market. And that's one of the great things about having that part of the portfolio. It's a defense mechanism. Then you get to the last part, the hedge fund. So we have two problems. Let's start with the problem, the first problem we have. Bonds have returned 4% a year for the last 17 years here. Interest rates now, even if you put a lot of corporate bonds into the mix and a bunch of other stuff, at best, you have maybe a 1.2% to 1.4% expected return on bonds from here, and that's because rates are as low as they are. So anything we have in bonds, we know for, at least for the near term, the next 5 years, let's say, or shorter, that we're not going to earn more than 1% to 1.5% per year if things go well. And it could be worse than that, by the way, if rates rise very much. So that's our first problem, is that our main mechanism for controlling volatility has a very, very low expected return today. So now the answer people have had for years, and we're no exception, is, well, let's not just put all of our defensive assets or our volatility moderating assets in bonds. Let's put some of them in hedge funds, and that'll be better. So the orange circle at the bottom is basically a great illustration of why that was a terrible idea. So that's the HFRI fund of funds composite, which is essentially an index of hedge funds. I won't torture you with all the details, but it's a good representation of what the industry has produced. And you can see it's been awful. That's about a 3% return per year net of fees in Italy. You would have been better off in bonds, and you wouldn't have paid all those fees. The fees are probably 2 to 3%. By the way, you get a 3% return. It's not pathetic. It's worse than pathetic. And that's why people hate hedge funds. So if the Community Foundation had done that, our blue circle wouldn't be sitting where it is right now. It would be lower, and it might be a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right. I'm not 100% sure. The maroon circle, though, which is entitled VCF Hedge Funds, That's the key point to think about. So that's the actual returns, or those are the actual returns of the hedge fund portfolio since 2003. And again, it's not a cherry-picked group. It's every good idea, every bad idea that we've had in the portfolio is in that number. And so that return, you can see, is just a little bit north of 6% per year. And I will tell you, and I think I mentioned this on prior calls, 7 to 8% is where we would like to be. So we're not thrilled to death with 6. However, it's played a valuable role in the portfolio, which is, first of all, it's had much more performance, much greater performance than bonds, about 4% up to 6%. And while you might say, well, 2% a year, what's the big deal? 2% per year over 17 years turns into something like 50% more return, believe it or not. It's a gigantic compounding effect. So it's had a big influence on the portfolio. And one of the reasons the blue circle is pulled to the left and higher is because of the hedge fund portfolio. And so this is a really central part of the strategy, and it's been a very effective one. So let me just stop there for a minute and see if there are any questions on that, because I want to kind of switch gears and talk more about the current market a little bit and what we're thinking about, and two, why we're so focused on volatility.
Does anyone have any questions for Mike? I think Kim is on muting everyone's line, but if you do have a question, you should be able to ask it. I think that's just background conversation. One thing I did want to point out, too, as Mike mentioned this a moment ago, is that every first quarter, so every our first committee meeting in the new year, the committee always reviews our asset allocation. We look at the overall strategy. We ensure that what we are doing still holds, and we will, if there's an opportunity that makes sense, in the long-term strategy, make some adjustments to our asset allocation. So this is a proactive conversation that we work really will provide us insights, but our committee, along with Dan Smith and myself, will participate in this conversation and ensure that we are understanding what we're doing, which we always should be, and then we also are looking long-term, and is there a change in strategy that makes sense with what we're understanding in the markets are not only just doing now, but in the long-term. So it's a very active conversation. So with that, Mike, I'll turn it back to you. And Kim, if you can mute everyone's line again, I'll appreciate it.
I have a question.
Ooh, thank you. Is that Tom?
It is.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. Mike, over the years, you've talked about volatility as being good because it creates some buying opportunities. But I noticed that there isn't any cash in the portfolio. So how do you buy when there's this kind of pullback in the market?
Great question, Tom. Thank you. What you do is you rebalance. So we have bond exposures that are actually soaring in value at this point. So what you can do is you can say, okay, my bonds are up 4% so far this year, and my stocks are down 7%. I'm going to sell some of those bonds and reinvest in stocks. And so that's one way you do it. The second thing that happens is at the manager level, there's two things that go on. One is that managers will, again, we haven't seen anything that is triggering much of this. By the way, the downturn so far has been pretty tepid. It's been dramatic, but it hasn't been a giant downturn, as you heard earlier. But the managers in the portfolio can upgrade. So there are stocks that have actually done very well over the last few weeks and months. Healthcare stocks like biotech companies have done well. Much to many people's surprise, Chinese stocks have done very well in this period of time. Some of the tech names have done well. So managers can start to sell those and purchase things that are more beaten down. And the last thing that happens is that the hedge fund managers in the portfolio will, they have short positions that are making money. They will cover those and buy more long stocks, i.e. increase the equity risk in their portfolios. So all those three levers, Tom, can lead to greater equity exposure and or higher quality exposure when people become very short-term oriented.
And has that happened in this portfolio?
Historically, yes. Currently, no. Nothing's happening. There's small movement, I will tell you, going on in terms of the manager level. Nothing dramatic yet. Again, you know, that's the thing that it's interesting to think about, which is that, you know, most of the decline this year is just giving back what had already been started off as profit for the year. So these 3 to 4% declines I talked about for the total portfolio, March was down a little more than that, of course. But it's not been a 20% drop or a 15 or 30% drop. So, you know, the bad news for those of you who are having a hard time with this is it could get better or it could get a lot worse if history is a guide. So there's nothing yet that's happened that has created that much of an opportunity, frankly.
Okay. Thanks, Tom, for the question. I'm going to ask him to mute everyone's line again just to remove the background noise, and we'll pause again for questions. Thank you, Jim. If everyone else, I think Tim is helping us with managing the call today, but if people can activate you star six just to make sure, and I think we are good to go. You can do star six again, everybody.
So now I'm going to ask you to jump ahead a little bit so we can talk about volatility for a minute. I keep alluding to how important it is to control it. And the reality is that if you didn't have to think about volatility, you could say, let's just put all the money in the stock market or some very simple mix of stocks and bonds and not worry about trying to squeeze every nickel we can out of the volatility that we do assume. And part of the reason that I think sometimes people worry about that is it's about career risk or reputational risk or just plain old-fashioned stress. It is more stressful when markets are dropping. It is more stressful to lose money. These are not easy things for anybody. And so one of the things I want to kind of get across today is that while all those things are important, we're really not incredibly focused on them. What we're really focused on is how do you actually make every dollar that comes to this foundation, how do you maximize its impact from a philanthropic standpoint? Because that's obviously why we're all here. So page 11 is meant to help illustrate this point in a very extreme way. So what we did is go back to 2002 again, and I said back to again the beginning of the work with the foundation, and we said let's invest $1 million shows up on that date, and let's invest it in one of three ways. In the pool, so we can talk about the long-term pool, in a 60% S&P 500, 40% Bloomberg Aggregate Bond Index, or just in the S&P 500. Now, I will tell you, I won't go down this road for very long. We actually completely think that all equity, all S&P, all U.S. stock portfolio is completely wrong. But with that said, we're using it here to illustrate the point that even if you're doing what we would argue is a very concentrated, very perilous strategy, this is still not a great outcome for you. So let's be clear about that. So now what we did, let's get back to the graph. So the blue bars, represent this $1 million. Now what we've done is we've invested in those three different portfolios I mentioned before. What we've also done is taken 5% out of a 20-quarter average each and every year from the portfolio. We'll talk about that in a minute. And nothing was added. So there's the million shows up. We take 5% out of a year for 17 years or so and add nothing. So now the first set of bars shows you that the VCF pool, at the end of all that activity, returns, grants, and spending, and no additions, basically picked up about $500,000 in net gains. So it's worth, let's say, about $1.5 million today. If it had been in the 60-40 mix, which includes the S&P, again, the wrong way to invest in equity portfolio, if it's exclusive, to be clear, it's worth about $1.4 million. Now, if it was just in the S&P 500, it would be worth about $1.7 million. And there's the voila moment, which is to say, well, see, you're wrong, right? You should have put all the money in the S&P 500, and you'd be better off. No. Turn to the next set of bars, which is the spending. So now you see, again, 5% of a 20-quarter average coming out, and the VCF pool investment basically distributed about $1 million. The S&P distributed just about a little over $800,000, and the Bloomberg mix, the mix of 60-40, was a little bit better than the S&P. So now you say, a lot less money was spent. It goes above the S&P 500. You might say, well, isn't that a good thing? The answer is, well, we'll talk about that a little bit later, but it wasn't a good thing, to be clear. Now, the last set of bars basically said, let's add the first two. How much more money do I have in my fund, and how much do I distribute? I think we can all agree that's philanthropic impact, and that's at least the impact of these dollars, or the potential of these dollars. Mm-hmm. Now you see, the S&P actually has the slightest of advantages. If I could run this through February 28th, it would no longer have the advantage, but let's not do that because I don't have that. But you'll see it's a slight advantage, but not much. It's basically equal. So whatever money is in this fund and the S&P portfolio that's not in the long-term pool portfolio, essentially it's just the difference in spending. They cancel each other out is what you're looking at here. So far, they've kind of said, well, isn't it great that the VCF pool has distributed more money than the S&P 500? Now, let's talk for a second about why that is. And that's all about volatility. So what happens is when the S&P 500 drops 40% like it did in 2008 or drops 8% like it did last month, what happens is that starts to affect the portfolio, and the 20-quarter average actually becomes a bit of an albatross because the portfolio value plunges in the S&P 500, but we're using a 20-quarter average, which means, which we do for a purpose, which is to stabilize spending. But if you're stabilizing spending in a volatile portfolio, what ends up happening is you start taking out a lot more than 5%. So at the worst part of the market cycle in 2008, 2009, you weren't taking out 5% of the S&P portfolio, you were taking out more like 9%.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a very destructive impact on the value of a fund here. There's just too much volatility and it's inconsistent with the spending policy. So that creates this very weird dynamic. Now, we ran this graph just a year or two ago before the S&P took off. The market value change of the S&P is actually lower than long-term pools. So because the rally has been so strong until recently, it's overcome that, but it can't overcome the spending problem, which we then go even one step further on page 12. Excuse me. So now this takes those middle set of bars, same portfolio, same distribution, same everything, and this shows you through time what it looks like. The blue line, again, is the VCF long-term pool. The orange line is the 60-40 mix, and the gray line is the S&P. So take a look. The S&P has a huge problem here, which is it's got a lot of downward pressure year to year. And, of course, that downward pressure coincides with bad economic conditions, bad market conditions. Now, you don't see it yet because this recent decline is not even in the numbers. But with that said, all the volatility of year-to-year spending is not just bad for philanthropy, it's very poorly timed on top of that. So it's a real, we would call it a philanthropic train wreck, which is that when the economy is suffering, you're not able to distribute as much if you're very aggressively invested. Now, contrast that with the blue line. It's not perfect. It flattens out at times, but generally speaking, it's a nice upward sloping line over time, and that is what I'm sure everyone in this room would agree is a much, much better pattern and picture to consider.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why volatility matters. It matters because we're using a smoothing formula, and the smoothing formula can get very distorted if you have too much volatility. And it matters because you don't want the portfolio fully exposed to every bad thing that happens in the economy or the world. So that's the point of the complexity. That's the point of the strategy. And hopefully, you know, over time, not hopefully, we expect to continue this. In fact, what we really expect to happen is when the S&P 500 is repriced at the right level, that gray bar is probably going to drop. And when that happens, the blue bar will be ahead, we think. And so that would be great news in terms of the wisdom of this strategy, which has been true over time. So one more thing, the current market climate. So I mentioned earlier all the things we don't know. Let's talk about what the game plan is, because that's really important. There has to be a game plan. So the first part of the game plan is realize what you don't know and try to make decisions that have a high probability of success and which take the other side of other people wanting to know that which they cannot know. So that's page 9. So point 1, be prepared. So I mentioned earlier, you can't start thinking about risk when it's punching you in the face. You need to have a plan. And the plan is to be diversified. And the diversification, it was getting a little tougher to defend over the last couple of quarters, I will tell you. You know, it's one of the things, we don't wish for bad things to happen, to be clear. But when nothing bad is happening, when risk is completely being forgotten, we do tend to find ourselves a little bit frustrated and a little bit lonely because we're just not out there saying, let's be as aggressive as humanly possible. Let's be really cautious. So preparation, which means be diversified and be diversified even when you feel foolish for being diversified. Point 2, and this is a big thing, make sure your managers are acting rationally. We can be as diversified as we want, we can be as long-term as we want, but the people who are managing the money in this portfolio, all these firms we use, they need to be acting rationally too. So we spend a lot of time thinking about that, and we do it by meeting with them, we do it by reading their publications, and we do it by watching the actual things they do in their portfolio. Talk is cheap, and watching what people actually do is a very, very good barometer of what's actually happening. And the last thing, this is what Tom's question for partially alluded to, which is there's opportunity in difficult times. What happens is that, first of all, short-term thinking dominates. That's a normal human emotion when things provoke fear. However, at the same time, when people are thinking short-term, the long-term investor has a bigger opportunity, essentially. So we think about it in two ways. One is more and more companies are being given to us, essentially, with extremely high expected returns and really relatively moderate intermediate-term risk. The second thing we do a lot here, and it's been a while, But when people start to panic, which is not happening yet, by the way, a lot of great investment firms that we love to use are suddenly available. A lot of times the great firms out there will not take new clients, will not take new capital. It's the opposite of what you probably experience as an individual investor, where everyone's always trying to get your money. A lot of these firms actually never want anyone's money, or rarely do. And we wait for these opportunities, and we come in and we upgrade the portfolio. So that's where, frankly, we get excited, is when we have these chances to do that. And by the way, the last time we got a really, really great chance to do that was about 10 years ago, when the financial crisis, some of the returns we've seen over the last decade came from decisions that were made 10 years ago, which were extremely productive for us, and things that we still have in the portfolio today. So we're not wishing again for bad things to happen, but when they do, we feel like, well, we can't control that, but we can control how we react, and so that's not a big issue. So last but not least, and then we have to take any questions you have, and further questions. Page 13 is another part of the roadmap. First thing, balance is always important. So by the way, even when markets plunge, to Tom's earlier question, you know, we will add to equity positions, but we're not going to put in gigantically new higher exposures, because then we will lose the balance that we always have to have in the portfolio. Because short-term results are important here, and we can't have so much risk in the portfolio that the short-term essentially kills us. So we're very balanced, and we're off to the second word, which is becoming incredibly important of late, is patience. We have things in the portfolio that have not been working for several years. We think they're fundamentally sound. We spend a lot of time thinking about that and working on that. But sometimes you have to sit there and you just have to wait. And it can be very frustrating, as you might guess, over time to wait, because you don't know how long you're going to have to wait. And it's very hard. But it can be done, and it has been done historically. The second point is how we kind of salve our wounds, which is we remind ourselves that every time markets get into this state, which they have been, there are extraordinary opportunities for patient capital. And so that's just an amazing thing. The third thing, which is, you know, really something we're sorry to see, is that a lot of investing these days has been towards, you know, more and more of the most popular market areas, things like what we call the fear trade, which is essentially, you know, what are considered safer stocks like utilities, REITs, consumer staples. These stocks are grossly overvalued. There's almost no scenario where these will prove to be good investments from here. And those investors, you know, to some degree, intentionally or not, are ignoring price. When you overpay for something, that's a great way to lose a lot of money over time. It's a big mistake, and we're very cognizant and hoping that people are not doing as much as we fear. And then the last thing is to ignore some of the noise. There's a lot of bad news out there. There will be increased bad news probably in the next 6 months over what's going on. But bad news isn't necessarily bad for long-term investors, and that's the other point that we are very focused on. So you struggle with these, with the yin and the yang here, being that you don't like to see declines, but you also do like to see opportunities, and so you try to focus on whichever one feels right at certain moments in time. So let me stop there and see if there are any questions that I can answer for you.
Dollars will fall out.
Okay, we just unmuted everyone's line, so if you had star muted, you were back live, just to put everyone on notice, we can hear you. And so now is the opportunity to ask any questions you might have of Mike and Tony here today.
Debbie and Mike, this is Charlie Kirker. Curious, Mike, your thoughts on how HIPs might perform. You know, I see they're still in a significant piece of the bond portfolio, and I don't think the U.S. has ever seen interest rates this low, you know, this 10 and 30 year, and I'm wondering what your expectation is about HIPs and whether they're going to be, you know, a good holding going forward.
Yeah, it's a great question, Charlie. Good to hear your voice. A couple things on check. So one is that just like the aggregate bonds, they're unbelievably they're unbelievably unappealing at the moment. Some have described all bonds as being return-free risk, which is probably about right. And of course, lo and behold, that's proven to be increasingly right over time, while the bond portfolio has been incredibly helpful to us. So the outlook is not great, I will tell you. But this is back to the balance point before. We're not going to give up on diversification or balance. And so we're going to hold on to these things. And the committee's going to have a chance to talk about this today, of course. But our intention is to hold on to these things. And I'll get to the tips in a minute. Because if you add up those two exposures, the aggregate bonds and the tips, it's about 13.7% of the endowment of long-term pool, excuse me. So that's a pretty low number. We won't go much lower than that, because that's enough to actually have some impact in terms of protecting us and not hurt us in terms of the future returns in any meaningful way, even if the returns aren't very good. So the tips specifically, and for those of you who don't think about bonds all day, tips are essentially inflation-protected bonds. I won't bore you with all the details, but in theory, they offer you modest protection against rising inflation. So tips were added to this portfolio years ago under the theory that, hey, at some point inflation might actually come back, which, of course, it's been a long time since we've seen any, which is interesting. And so they're a diversifier, essentially, in a lousy asset class like bonds. So our view, and I'll tell you, this is looking increasingly foolish, but we still think it's probably going to prove right, which is that I think conventional wisdom has now become that there is not going to be any inflation for a very long time, that interest rates are going to be lower for longer. And by the way, that view, just like those who believe the S&P 500 will always outperform, has been amply rewarded over the last few years, which is why it's dangerous. And one of my favorite lines in the history of markets from an investor is this phrase, which is, risk is greatest when agreement is greatest. Mm-hmm. And so our view is that, you know what? Everyone thinks inflation is dead, which means it'll probably come back sooner than anyone realizes, although we're not going to make a prediction. But what we do think is when it does, and if it does, or when it does, I should say, that we like the idea of having something that will do badly, because it's still a high-quality government bond. It's got very low yields today, but not as badly as the rest of our bonds. And so, therefore, we're going to hold the tips, Charlie, because we think that they are a lousy idea until you start thinking about their role in a diversified portfolio.
Any other questions? And thanks, Charlie, for asking that. I'm not sure if the lines are unmuted, but I'm hoping that they are. So I guess that's it. Without any other questions, we will wrap up the call. Just a reminder that the call will be put on our website as well as the slide deck. Feel free to reference back to that, and we all do have a history of our calls on there as well. So thank you again for participating. We appreciate you guys asking questions and being on the call, and we appreciate you working with the Vermont Community Foundation. Have a great rest of your day. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.